This morning, I would like to give the final talk of my kind of year-long series on the Eightfold Path, and which is now is the last part is right samadhi. And the Eightfold Path is an integrated part of a practice teaching of the Buddha called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths in our tradition, in early Buddhism, is really kind of the heart of the tradition. And it's kind of this amazing jewel that reflects all kinds of other aspects of Buddhism. It ties into all other aspects of Buddhism. It said that all the teachings of the Buddha somehow are a continuation or an elaboration on the Four Noble Truths. And it's deceptively simple, the Four Noble Truths. A 10-year-old can understand the basic idea. And so because it's so deceptively simple, it's easy not to see how profound it is and how it kind of relates to, the most profound aspects of our life and to liberation. And I say that because recently I was teaching, I did a day-long teaching for a group of people who are being trained to be Buddhist teachers in a variety of Mahayana Buddhist traditions. And I asked them at one point, what was the second noble truth? And none of them could say. And some of them said ignorance. One person got closest was attachment. And I was kind of flabbergasted that someone becoming Buddhist teachers didn't even know the Four Noble Truths. But when I stopped back for a moment and realized, wait a minute, it's because this thing is so core to the Theravada tradition, the early Buddhist tradition, was kind of lost or superseded or kind of forgotten later in Buddhism and other traditions. And so it doesn't have its, or it's there a little bit, but it's kind of considered to be, elementary kind of Buddhism and not as profound as the great profound teachings of emptiness or something. And that's a little bit unfortunate because I feel that the Four Noble Truths are not elementary or kindergarten Buddhism. They're actually very, very sophisticated, even though they appear very simple. And it's said that not until full awakening, full liberation, does someone really understand the Four Noble Truths. So you can understand it's simple. So the Four Noble Truths are this. First one is the truth of suffering. That's all it says. It's the truth of suffering. And the idea is for you to understand suffering. And each of these Four Noble Truths has an activity or practice connected to it. So you're not being asked to believe them as truths. You're asked to pick them up as practices to explore your life, understand your life. So the first is the truth of suffering. That's all it says. It doesn't say, life is suffering. It just says there's the truth of suffering. And the task, the practice there, is to understand suffering, to understand your suffering. And so this is counterintuitive for many people who are always running away from their suffering or trying to fix it too quickly. The idea is to really understand it well. And I see this as a very mature aspect of Buddhist practice, is that you're actually supposed to stop and really kind of be present and see and understand what it's all about, the ways in which you feel stress, anxiety, fear, all the different forms of suffering that we have. So the first is the noble truth of suffering. The second is the noble truth of the cause of suffering. So now as we're understanding suffering, we're also beginning to understand the task there, the second noble truth, is to not only understand suffering, begin understanding the causes of it, and then to begin to let go of the causes. So the cause is defined not by desire, because if it's defined by desire, then it seems like all desire is a problem, and Buddhists are not allowed to have any desire at all. And then it just looks like you're depressed all the time. The Buddhists are encouraged to have desire in the teachings of the Buddha, but not desire that's characterized by clinging or craving or grasping. The word that Buddha uses, tanha, or thirst. And so the idea, the task of the second noble truth is to release the grip of grasping. So if you're grasping, it kind of hurts. If you grasp long enough, you get tired. And so your idea is to release that. And same thing with the mind or the heart. If you grasp long enough, you get pretty tired, pretty wearing. And in fact, It's possible to get physically sick by spending too much time grasping or clinging or resisting in some way. And the mind that grasps in all its various forms is also a mind which is not settled and relaxed on itself. A mind which is grasping can be very focused on what it wants, but it's not relaxed, not soft, it's not at ease. And if the mind that's grasping eases up a little bit, then it tends to jump around. And the analogy is that of a monkey. It's called monkey mind. And this is where the mind, apparently the idea of the monkey, as soon as it grabs one branch, is off trying to grab another branch, or one fruit and another fruit. Just, you know, always going, 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 as opposed to sitting still. So the mind kind of grasps onto one branch of thought. And as soon as it does that, it kind of swings over to the next one, and then the next one. So it's scattered. And so the mind is not settled or focused in a relaxed way. It's not at peace with itself. But the mind is kind of is dispersed or scattered or flitting about. At one place, the Buddha talked about the mind being like a fish out of water, you know, flapping around in the ground. You know, just flapping. Sometimes it can feel that way in the mind. And some of you probably had the experience, probably all of you, the experience of trying to sit down and meditate and being surprised that the mind has a mind of its own. You know, how much the mind wanders away and goes off and this and that and floats away, flaps away, races away. And you feel lucky to come back. And sometimes people report, you know, it takes sometimes 5, 10, 15 minutes to even notice that their mind has drifted off in thought and all that. So the mind is considered to be scattered, or the mind is considered to be dispersed or fragmented. So the mind of clinging, the mind of grasping, is one that often has this quality of dispersion or scatteredness or unsettledness. So the idea with the task of the second noble truth is to release that grasping. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation. The truth of the cessation of suffering, the cessation of the grasping. And so there's something qualitatively different happens when you've done the work of releasing. And then you experience what's called cessation, which sounds kind of like the absence of something, the ceasing of something, which doesn't seem like a great lofty spiritual goal. But the cessation of grasping is a wonderful experience of great happiness and peace, well-being, that's incomparable, if it's done completely, incomparable to anything else. And this is called liberation in Buddhism. These first three things, understanding suffering, understanding the cause of it and letting go of the cause, and then experiencing the bliss of cessation, is not considered to be an easy thing to do. You might be able to do it in small ways, things that are pretty easy to let go of. However, in big ways, there's very deep-seated places of clinging and holding in our hearts and minds that can cause a lot of distress and worry. Maybe not all the time, but they're latent, ready to rear their heads when different situations arise. And so because it's so latent, so deeply rooted, the forces of clinging, and it's not so easy to let go, then the fourth noble truth is the path, the Eightfold Path, the path to be able to accomplish the first three tasks. And so it's support that enables the first three tasks to be done well. And so the Eightfold Path is an integrated practice that's meant to include all of you. And the idea is we walk the path. And back in ancient India, they didn't have cars and things, so people walked. And so walking the path, I like the analogy of walking, the idea of walking, because it's something you do with your whole being. You can't be a couch potato and walk. You know, you have to kind of enter into the path and actually walk it. So the idea of the path is it's integrated and includes all of who you are. And the Buddha had these eight different steps. Now, it's possible that if the Buddha lived in modern world, modern California, he might have added a few steps, you know, to the Eightfold Path. Maybe it would have been a Ninefold Path or a Tenfold Path. I think for many people, you know, I have the suspicion that maybe if he knew how people were living in California these days, many people, he would have had right exercise. But you know, back in his days, he walked all the places. You know, he was walking all over India. By the time he was 80, he was still walking hundreds of miles. You know, in these big tours of the countryside. So you stay pretty fit when you do that a lot of walking. So you don't need to tell people to, you know, exercise. But for us, some of us. And I don't know if he would have said something like, right TV watching. right media. He wouldn't have said anything about media for the monks, maybe for the lay people. Maybe for the monastics, he would have made the 228th rule for monks. No television. he was teaching back, way back, different time, place. So he had these eightfold path. And over the year, we're talking about the different steps of the eightfold path. And they're understood to be integrated together, like the strands of a rope that they're needed all together to make a strong rope. You need all eight working together. But also, they're also useful to think of them sequential, that they lay the foundation for each other. And so, the middle section of these, which is ethics, right action, livelihood, have to do with how we live our lives in the world and how ethically we are. And so people who focus on being ethical sometimes talk about ethical purity, or purity of heart or purity of mind. And the tradition, Buddhist tradition, uses the word purity periodically. When I was a teenager, I would have felt oppressed by people talking about purity, because sometimes it's held in funny ways. But there's something really beautiful about a mind and a heart which is pure. A simplicity, a cleanliness, a clarity of mind. When the mind is not in conflict, the mind is not driven, when the mind is not consumed by anger or resentment or all these different things that kind of make the mind agitated or sully the mind or cause pain in the mind. A mind which is pure is really a beautiful thing. But as we attain some degree of purity of mind, it's a lot easier then to begin settling the mind. For example, in meditation, and to quiet the mind. When the mind is impure, it's much harder to settle it. You might next time you do something like rob a bank, and then try to sit down and meditate afterwards. Chances are that you're not going to be very calm. don't do that. That's not a good idea to rob banks. But the idea being that certain behaviors makes it hard for your mind to get calm. And some of the behavior is not unethical, but just some of the ways in which people run around. Some of the way I've noticed that how I drive my car affects how easy it is for me to get calm. Go meditate right after driving. And so maybe it's not unethical, to drive certain ways, but the ways in which I'm clinging or craving or pushing or trying to get someplace quickly and tightening up and all that affects the state of my consciousness. If I drive in a calm, relaxed way, it affects my consciousness in a different way. If I take 280 up to San Francisco, I arrive feeling different than if I take 101. And so, it's not unethical to take 101, I don't think. But so the idea is that if you can create the right conditions for your heart and mind, then it's easier to settle. And then the function of the last three of the Eightfold Path, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, is to really settle and continue the work of purifying or simplifying or stabilizing the mind. So the mind, or the heart, becomes more and more useful. So to help the mind and heart, the mind becomes a more useful instrument for seeing really deeply into itself, into this world of ours. And the mind becomes more and more malleable or workable or relaxed so that it can do the deep work of release, of letting go. It's one thing to see what you have to let go of. And it's another thing to be able to do it. And I've seen, you know, I need to let go of that, but don't have a clue how I'm going to let go of that part of the mind. Just, you know, where, you know, can't look around. Where's that clinging? You know, I know I'm clinging, but where do I find the button? Or where do I find... But when the mind starts getting simple and stable, it also tends to get softer. And as it gets softer, it becomes easier to find where the release point is. And you can let go. So right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Right mindfulness is the second to last, and it can be seen as a foundation for right concentration, right samadhi. And right mindfulness is the capacity to be present for what your experience is. So to be present for your breath, present for your bodily experience, present for the world we live in, as opposed to the mind floating off or the mind being reactive. And so it's a big training to learn how to be present and keep the mind in the present moment. And it's a big training to learn how not to be reactive to what's going on. Because if you're reactive, you're always reacting to things, either because you want them more or you want them less or something. The mind can't settle. You just live like the monkey. So it's a training to learn how to have the mind be equanimous or peaceful, even when things are uncomfortable. And also be equanimous when things are beautiful and wonderful. Just to stay cool, stay relaxed, so that you don't sully or muddy the ability to see what's going on. One of the big trainings of mindfulness is to begin to see clearly what is called the five hindrances. And those are the five hindrances are things that hinder the ability to see clearly, or hinder the ability to be stable and settled. The five hindrances can be some of the primary fuel for the monkey mind, for this grasping mind that can be there. And so a big part of mindfulness is learning to understand how desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, and then I learned a new words for the fourth hindrance yesterday. Worry and flurry. And that goes along with sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor and worry and flurry. They're usually called restlessness and anxiety. And then the last hindrance is doubt. These can be very powerful forces in the mind. Sometimes they operate together as in combination, make even more forceful. Can cause a tremendous amount of damage in the world, a tremendous amount of damage in for ourselves when they get the upper hand. So part of the function of mindfulness is to start understand these things, see how they work, see how they work their magic on us, so we get caught by them, and then learn how not to be caught by them, learn how to settle them. And it's said that these five hindrances are the primary obstacles. There's other obstacles as well, but the primary obstacles for the mind to feel settled in the present moment, to feel settled here and now. And a marvelous thing happens. It feels like magic or a great beauty when the mind stops kind of racing after thoughts and images and concerns, and the mind really feels like the mind is kind of like settled, stabilized, rooted here and now. And the mind's not going to go wander off and change. You feel comfortable, you feel kind of reassured, you feel confident, you're here in a stable, clear way, and you're confident that for at least for the time being, the mind's not going to wander off on you. It might wander off in thought very briefly, but you kind of see it happening and you can easily kind of reestablish yourself back here. And there's a wonderful feeling. It can be really wonderful to have this feeling of stability, of here you are, your mind's not wandering off. It's a turning point in meditation. When you come to this place, the mind is really here and you have confidence that it's here. And it's a kind of a delight. It's kind of a wonderful, nice feeling. It's a relief. It's refreshing. It's a delight. And the Buddha recognized it as being a delight. And you're encouraged to take it as a delight, because that delight then becomes, it makes it easier for you to want to be even more present. To really kind of, okay, this feels really good. I'm not going to rest on my laurels, but let's take this delight and help me kind of get more focused, more concentrated. So then the next step of the Eightfold Path is, last step is right samadhi. And samadhi is a very powerful word, significant word in Indian religions, in Indian spirituality. It's used in other Buddhist Indian religions besides Buddhism. In fact, in some Indian religions, the word samadhi has almost like the ultimate goal of the religion, like enlightenment itself in their particular tradition, how they understand it, is called samadhi. It's a very, very significant term. In Buddhism, it's a very significant term, but it's not limited to, it doesn't define, you know, the ultimate goal of liberation or freedom. It's a step to it. And the different religious traditions of India have different definitions of the word samadhi, so it's not like they have, you know. But anyway, it's a very important term. And I say that because we want to be careful not to limit its translation into English by concentration. It's often translated into English as concentration. And because I believe that some people, when they hear the word concentration, think of samadhi as kind of this laser focus, one-pointed focus. You take your mind's eye and you're going to lock it onto something and keep it there, and that's what it's all about, this mental function of just, you know, looking and keeping it there on the candle flame. You're not going to let it waver from the candle flame. You're just going to keep the attention there. One-pointedness is part of samadhi, but samadhi is a much broader term, broader state, broader than this one-pointedness. Samadhi is a state. It's not a particular functioning of the mind. So, you know, there's a state of being or overall mood that you go into. So if you walk down the street, you can kind of notice sometimes the mood or the state people are in. You see, oh, that person's in a depressed state. They're all slumped over or something and kind of oozing. Or that person's angry. Anger just oozes out. Or someone's really happy. You kind of feel it's contagious, the happy state that person's in. The state is a broader thing than just having a happy thought or an angry thought bubble up. I've had anger kind of bubble up inside of me. Sometimes it just feels like a little thing that bubbles up. It doesn't define or color my overall sense of being. And I've had anger kind of define, you know, my overall state of being and who I am. People just got to stay away, you know, please. So samadhi is a state that's palpable, certainly for the person who's having it, but sometimes it's palpable for the person who is in the presence. And you can really feel, oh, there's something going on here, a different state. Very concentrated, very focused, very calm. The kind of overall kind of state the person's in. One of the strong words associated with samadhi is unification. It's a state of being unified, where rather than being fragmented, where all the different many different aspects of who we are fragmented, going in different directions, everything is unified for the same purpose, for the same direction, here and now. So some of you might have come today, maybe you had some terrible argument at work this week, and so the lingering feeling of anger is somehow lingering in your body, and so it's here, kind of here a little bit. But also you're excited to be at a Buddhist center. So there's also the anger there, but it's a little bit of excitement there about being at a Buddhist center. But also you're hungry, and part of your mind is thinking about, I wonder what they have for tea today out there. They talked about all this food out there. So part of you is thinking about tea. Part of you is thinking about the work thing and the feelings and the body left over from that and the feelings of excitement of being at a Buddhist center. So all these things can be going on at once. And in a sense, you're fragmented. You're kind of multitasking. Unification is when you stop the multitasking and everything is kind of unified together here and now. So you're really kind of engaged fully in this particular thing you're doing here. And I don't think it's a foreign idea to people, this kind of unification. I suspect that it happens to some of you if you have some activity you really love doing. Even reading a good book can do that. Or involved in a hobby can do that. Or even going for a run can do that. Or maybe taking a shower sometimes, you know, because just things can fall away or whatever, relax. Concentration practice is this practice of once the hindrances have abated, and once you've kind of settled or rooted or clicked into the present moment, and you realize the mind's not going to drift off anymore, and this way and that way, but you're here, then the mind becomes more useful. Then you have a tool you can apply. You can't really apply a tool if the tool keeps flying out of your hand. Right? You know, okay, I got this good screwdriver, I'm going to unscrew this, you know, and then, you know. But once you kind of can, you know, you hold your hand steady and it's not, you're not going to drop the tool anymore, then you have it, and the tool is useful. So the mind is useful once it's steady. And you can hold it steady and you can kind of keep it focused. So as you so samadhi, concentration practice, really clicks in when the mind is stabilized, when the hindrances are no longer operating. Then right samadhi, right concentration in the Buddhist tradition, in the early Buddhist tradition, is defined by being absorbed, really unified and absorbed in what you're paying attention to. So if you're paying attention to your breath, you're not casually involved in your breath, but the breath becomes kind of basically your universe. You're so interested in the breath, you're so involved in the breath, that you know, you're not thinking about your taxes. You're not thinking about what's for lunch. You're not thinking about what happened yesterday. You know, you're not even paying much attention at all to sounds around you. It becomes uninteresting, you know, and so you may not even know that you might not be hearing at all because you're so interested. Just like you would for a really good hobby. You know, your really good hobby, you're so involved, you don't hear the neighbor's dog barking. But when you're trying to meditate, of course, then, oh, look at that dog, you know, bothering me. Until you get concentrated, right? So the so you get so interested, so involved in what you're doing. And this sense of involvement, engagement, I think is an important concept to understand, or interest. Because if you don't have the sense of interest or sense of purpose or a sense of purity, or, you know, it's hard to want to do it. And a big part of the negotiation of meditation is beginning to question, understand, and then to question what your mind is interested in. And of course, you have what you think you want your mind is interested in, what you want your mind to be interested in. Yes, I want to be interested in meditation, thank you. With great sense of purpose, aspiration, you're connected to a great world religion, it's so great, it has liberation as the end goal, it's what you most want in your life, you sit down to meditate, you're serious about it, 2 seconds later, you're thinking about dinner. What happened? This is the most important thing in the world for me, to meditate, and why am I thinking about dinner? Or whatever else. The mind, as for whatever its reasons, can have very strong interest that is different from what you want to be interested in. And so part of the kind of maturing, personal maturing process of meditation is to begin to question and analyze and look into what is it that interests the mind? What's the best interest for yourself? And to be able to settle things which are not so interesting ultimately, or to put them aside temporarily so you can really kind of pursue something which has maybe more ultimate meaning for you. So this absorption, you get absorbed in this. Now remember, there was this delight that arose when you finally could be here in a clear, settled way. In order to enter into samadhi, you have to have a sense of being relaxed, at ease, tranquil, and a little bit happy. You can't kind of... People hear about, oh, concentration is a big thing in Buddhism, I want to get concentrated, and then they bear down. You know, they kind of grit their teeth, and they're, I'm going to get concentrated. And if I don't get concentrated, you know, before, you know, 10:45, you know, or then, you know, I have to get concentrated before, you know, this guy next to me, you know, and, you know, this competitive concentration. I don't say this lightly. I say it because a lot of people suffer because they try so hard to get concentrated. It's like they strive and they push. And it becomes counterproductive. The very attempt to get concentrated prevents the possibility. Or if you do get concentrated, it's a brittle concentration. Or it's a kind of concentration that comes through repression. You're kind of like actually holding a lot of stuff at bay. Kind of, you know, because it's so soft. So the idea is to have the mind soft. And so you can't try too hard. If you try too hard, it doesn't really work. And sometimes you're better off trying, you know, 70% when you meditate, or 50%. Maybe even 10% is good enough. You know, just because that's actually more that being relaxed than ease. So then, having that delight and using some sense of well-being that arises through meditation at this point as part of the encouragement, as the biofeedback system that helps you to kind of get more focused. And the biofeedback kind of idea is maybe helpful here. Biofeedback, you have an instrument that beeps or something when you enter into a particular state of mind or something. And then you know, oh, that's what I'm looking for. And then you know what you're doing and you kind of get this feedback and you can do more and more. So the same thing with samadhi. You start getting the symptoms of samadhi, symptoms of concentration start arising. You feel more relaxed, you feel lighter, you feel more spacious. Some of the boundaries of your hard, tight body begins to dissolve. There's feelings of pleasure bubble up, joy bubbles up. And those kinds of sensations become the feedback loop. Oh, that's good, I'm on track. It's like cheerleaders, good. And because it feels so good, you're kind of, I'm on the right track and I want to keep going. And so you're staying with the breath, for example, and you're kind of the breath, it's kind of a rhythm to the breath. And it kind of, it can feel after a while, it's kind of like petting a cat. You know, the cat starts purring. And your body starts purring, the inner purring. And different people experience the purring different ways. There's a lot of different ways, but it doesn't have to be like purring exactly, but, you know, that kind of nice kind of thing, nice way. So I feel like you're like a cat, you know, sitting in the sun. And so then, as you do your concentration, your absorption, your involvement, and your unification, it's all kind of going together. Then a variety of state shifts can begin happening. Sometimes those state shifts, because we're talking about states here, right? Those state shifts can happen suddenly, or sometimes they happen very, very gradually. You almost don't see the transition between them. And those state shifts, there's four of these state shifts, and when the Buddha defined right concentration, he defined them by these four state shifts. The first one, it's just kind of really good, and because I'm running out of time. The second one is defined by having a lot of joy. Sometimes it can be rapturous joy. The third one is more peaceful. If you're going from more and more peaceful states, and being more peaceful is more satisfying. So you go from joy to happiness, or a deeper kind of embodied sense of satisfaction or pleasure. And that's much more pleasant, much more satisfying than joy. And so you go into this happiness mode. And then from there, there's a state shift, and the happiness fades away, and it's replaced by something that's much more satisfying than the happiness, which is primarily characterized by equanimity or peace and clarity. Great clarity, great peace, great equanimity. And the mind is very even and has no tendency to react to anything. There's no very little, not only that, not, doesn't react, but there's a very little experience of pleasure or pain. Now, how can it be so pleasant and satisfying if there's no pleasure? Well, it does. You're not involved in the sensual world of pleasure and pain. And so the mind is very, very peaceful. This is not the end all. The purpose of Buddhist practice is not to, you know, have wonderful, peaceful state like this, you know, concentration states. You don't want to get stuck there. The reason for this is so the mind is the reason these concentration practices are a number of reasons. One reason is it can be very healing, because one way where people are wounded is they're fragmented, and as you get unified, you're not fragmented anymore, and so the various places in which we're kind of split from ourselves gets healed, and it's very, very helpful to have that healing process happening. Also, there can be a strong sense of well-being with concentration, and that well-being can begin melting the places of being wounded or lonely or feeling hurt by things of the world or whatever it might be. And you kind of, finally begin relaxing. It's hard to relax when you feel always wounded, but when you have this great sense of well-being, you can kind of soften and relax the places of psychological wounding. And for some people, that's very helpful. Also, it makes the mind very, as I keep saying, soft. And it's easier, you know, to relax the grip of the mind if the mind is soft. And so your mind is getting softer and softer, so some of the deeper places of holding can be released. And finally, the mind that's concentrated is very still, stable. And it gives you a chance, it gives you a chance for mindfulness to see, the mind to see clearly in a way that it, and deeply in a way it can't in normal consciousness, in normal kind of mind kind of being busy and scattered. And so it's kind of like having a telescope, looking at a star. If you hold it, you can't be still enough to see the star. You have to have it on a tripod. Or if you use a mirror to see yourself clearly on a train, you know, it doesn't work so well. But if the train stops, then you can have a clear image of yourself in the mirror. Or if you have the telescope on a tripod, then you can see well to see the star far away. So if you want to see yourself really clearly and deeply, there's no unconscious in Buddhism because there's subconscious, no unconscious, because the idea is if your mind is still enough and clear enough, you can see it all. And if you want to see reality clear enough with a telescope of the mind, you have to have this tripod. And that, so that's the stability of stillness is what samadhi provides. And so then at some point, so the last function of samadhi is this ability to be still enough so you can really see clearly in a way you can't see other ways. And those combination of those things then sets the stage for the mind to be able to be completely liberated and freed. And so mindfulness is the foundation for concentration. And concentration is a foundation for this deep mindfulness. Concentration and mindfulness go hand in hand. It's not necessary to go into these deep states of samadhi for mindfulness to do all its work, all the way to liberation. It's not necessary. So don't feel like now you have to rush out and get into the fourth samadhi. However, you need to have very strong concentration for mindfulness to do all the work it needs to do if you want to take the path, the Eightfold Path, all the way to its end. If you want to use the Four Noble Truths to really use, kind of realize the Four Noble Truths at the profoundest level. And so part of the task of mindfulness practitioners is to one way or other understand how they couple, how they unite concentration, how they bring concentration in along as a partner to mindfulness. So there is one place, I believe, in the suttas where the Buddha does offer a ninefold path. And I believe, if my memory serves me right, in the one place where he says it, he calls the ninth piece right liberation. In any case, it's all leading towards liberation, to freedom. It's a beautiful potential that we all have. And it's something that it's a well worth, very honorable and worthwhile thing to pursue in human life. As the monk Ajahn Chandoko said last week, it doesn't matter how far you get, it's just a great thing to be on the path. And as Bruce and Inez go off on their retreat over the next part of the year, may they just find tremendous delight on each step of the path as they walk it, no matter how far they get. Thank you. Mm-hmm.